For those of us who've been lucky enough to be here all day, this is the culminating event at the Intersectionality Act 30, happy birthday, event hosted by the Department of Gender Studies. And I know many of the people in this room today have been waiting to hear Kimberly speak today, so I'm not going to hold things up at all. My name's Sadie Waring, and I'm from the Department of Gender Studies here, and I'd like to welcome everybody here, whether you've been here today or not. It's a real, genuine, total, utter privilege, as well as an enduring pleasure to be welcoming and introducing Professor Kimberly Crenshaw tonight. And in just a few minutes, I'm going to hand her over to you so that she can speak to the title, 30 Years of Theorizing Justice, Intersectional Critical Race Theory and Contemporary Challenges. And as I say, we'll be introducing her in a moment. But just to tell you how the event is going to go, Professor Crenshaw will speak for about 50 to 55 minutes. And then we have a respondent, Claire Hemmings, who I will introduce after you've heard from Professor Crenshaw. So, without further ado. And at that point, there'll be a chance to have a Q&A at the end of the response from Claire. So it's not possible to overemphasize the extraordinary influence that Professor Crenshaw has made to the field of gender and race justice. She's Professor of Law at UCLA and Columbia Law School and is leading authority in the area of civil rights, black feminist legal theory, and race, racism, and the law. Her articles have appeared in the Harvard Law Review, the National Black Law Journal, Stanford Law Review, and Southern Californian Law Review. She's the founding coordinator of the Critical Race Theory Workshop and the co-editor of the volume Critical Race Theory, Key Documents That Shaped the Movement. Her groundbreaking work on intersectionality has traveled globally, and both she and the concept, or as I've heard it described today, as both an analytic sensibility and also a gift, has had a significant impact on global legal affairs in the drafting of the Equality Clause in the South African Constitution and in relation to the key role played by her on race and gender discrimination for the United Nations World Conference on Racism. She's worked extensively on a variety of issues pertaining to gender and race in the US domestic arena, including violence against women, structural racism, racial inequality, and affirmative action. She served as a member of the National Sciences Foundation's Committee to Research Violence Against Women, and she's the co-founder and executive director of the African American Policy Forum, a gender and racial justice legal think tank, and the founder of the executive director for the Center of Intersectionality and Social Policy Studies at Columbia Law School. She's a leading voice in calling for a gender-inclusive approach to racial justice interventions, having spearheaded the Why We Can't Wait campaign and co-authored Black Girls Matter, Pushed Out, Overpoliced and Unprotected, and Say Her Name, Resisting Police Brutality Against Black Women. Please join me in warmly welcoming Professor Kimberly Crenshaw.
Thank you. So before we get started, I need to ask your permission for something. I'd like to take a selfie. All right, so I'm going to get you guys first and then you guys, okay? All right, on the count of three. I was kind of afraid to do that because I have to find my speech again, so thank God it's here. So first of all, it's just been such a delight this day has been a culmination of a wonderful 3.5 years that I've spent here. I didn't know what it was like to actually be in a department with colleagues that we could start a conversation not with, is gender relevant, but how is it relevant? I just didn't have an understanding of how great that could be. So I want to express my deepest gratitude to all of my colleagues at the Gender Institute, and especially, of course, Claire Hemmings, who has been my partner in so many things, particularly a crazy course we decided to try to do intersectionality in a week. And thanks to all of you who survived that. We decided to try to talk through someone who decided that they didn't want to have us talk. And Claire was like, we decided we'd invent these super women memes. Claire sort of just ran to this guy who tried to disrupt my talk. I've said she's my hero from now on in. I want her to travel with me everywhere. But, you know, together we have been able to think through some perilous times, how to sustain the projects that hold us all together and that brought us here. And the Institute has given me a home away from home. I'm not gone. I'm just, you know, I'm a distant relative, and I hope that I get invited back a lot. So thank you, Claire. I also want to thank everyone who organized this conference and made it possible. I would like to thank Manoush Shafiq, Abira Khan, Kate Stewart, and all of my colleagues at the Institute, and everyone who traveled to come and participate and take time in this important day. I mean, it's great to come to a birthday party. This was a wonderful one. I also have to say that, you know, as anniversaries go, the 20th one, I'll just say the bar for this was pretty low to make it a success over that one. Because the first one, I was invited to come celebrate intersectionality, and by the time I got there, it had acquired a question mark. As Barbara Tomlin said yesterday, celebrating intersectionality. So the fact that there were no surprises like that today made it a tremendous success for me, not to mention the wonderful talks that everyone's given. So this 30th anniversary comes, as I call this, a Dickinsonian moment, meaning this reflects the best of times and the worst of times for intersectionality. So, you know, the best of times. The other day, well, it was actually now a couple of weeks ago, maybe in a month ago, all of a sudden I started getting a lot of Twitter notifications. So, you know, what's going on? I look in Twitter notification, and I see that Ariana Grande has said, if it's not intersectional, it's not feminist, right? So, and then everyone's like, yeah, that's great. Okay, so maybe that's the best of times, but then the inverse actually happens, in which it's not at all clear what Ariana Grande thinks intersectionality actually is, which leads to the worst of times around intersectionality. So all of this has prompted a deeper, I guess I say wider debate about what intersectionality is, which in turn has created a lot of mythology around intersectionality, a lot of distortion around intersectionality, and some out and out attacks on intersectionality. We had an event last night at Westminster, and I have to thank many of the folks sitting here in the first couple rows who participated in that, and my good colleague Eddie, who made it possible for us to be there. And the point of that was to engage in a myth-busting activity. So I could go for like 30 minutes actually giving you some of the myths and responding to it, but in the spirit of levity in which we're celebrating intersectionality, I think this little 3-minute video might do a better job at it. So let's take a look.
Okay. Hi, I'm Katie Goodman. And hey, Carlita. You busy?
No. What's up?
This is Carlita Victoria. I'm just writing a little song.
Live? On camera?
Yeah, most of this stuff I just make up on the spot.
Okay. How can I help?
Well, you know what I was thinking about?
What's that?
I was thinking about intersectional feminism.
You were?
Yeah, I was thinking like maybe a folk song about intersectionality. I think it's a beautiful thing.
You do?
Yeah, it's like we're sisters, unified in our cause. We're both resistors. Good rhyme, right? Something about sex is lost.
I don't think you know what intersectionality means.
No, wait, it's coming. I intersect with you, you intersect with me. That's why we call it intersectionality.
No. Hold on. While I feel the same affection, it's not that type of intersection that we're talking about today. See, I'm an African American woman,
and I am a Caucasian American woman. So our causes are one and the same. They intersect.
I don't feel like you're listening.
Because we're sisters, unified in our cause. Yeah, resistors.
Katie. Let's say in my town, there's a company, and I'm hoping that they have a job for me.
And?
And on the factory floor, they hire men of all colors, black men, Latino men, and all the rest. And in the office, there's white women who hire more white women, 'cause that's the women that they know the best. So on paper, the discrimination's not so clear. They hire plenty of women over here, and men of color over there. But if you're a woman who's of color, as I happen to be, well, then they don't hire me. And that's intersectionality.
That's what that means?
That's what that means.
Oh.
If you're black, there's discrimination. If you're a woman, it's there too. But if you happen to be both, then
it double sucks for you.
You got it. That's intersectionality. Then add on top of that, if you're trans or gay, or if you're differently abled in some way,
that's when the discrimination multiplies radically.
Yeah. You got it. That's intersectionality.
That's intersectionality.
Yeah, that's intersectionality. You got it.
But I want to do intersectionality too.
Well, you're a straight white woman, so you only got one thing going for you there. So it's not for you.
Oh, I made out with a woman in college once.
Okay. Here's what you can do. You can help by being aware of it, by making sure that feminist issues aren't just straight white feminist issues.
Okay, I can do that. You know why? 'Cause we're sisters, unified in our cause.
Yeah. We're sisters.
I love your hair.
Thank you.
Can I touch your hair?
You cannot touch my hair.
Katie Goodman. You can find it at katiegoodman.com. So that takes me through like the first six pages of my talk, right? It basically articulates intersectionality as a word picture to deal with the ways in which law was not prepared to and had no analytic to address the ways that black women experienced discrimination. It was also designed to interrogate the ways that discrimination was imagined by those who were meant to represent women of color, namely feminists and anti-racist civil rights advocates. Since then, the term has come to be identified in relation to many, many things, which is true, but it's not just those things. So it has been associated with identity, and it does have an identity component, but it's not just about identity. It is a product of black feminist thinking, but it's not only about black women. It reflects encounters with law, but it speaks far beyond juridical categories. It is grounded in the urgency of contesting power, but it also finds inadvertent expression among defenders of the status quo who have lately mobilized straight white male identities as the purported victims of intersectionality. Now, some of their critique, and by this I mean the anti-intersectionality people, some of their critique is actually a nostalgia, a way of trying to retell history that takes us back to a time before we had to deal with any of these questions of identity, much less have to deal with questions of intersectionality. That in turn, I think, prompts a question about how do we respond to this nostalgia, to this effort to use history as a way of undermining intersectionality. In other words, to take us back to a time where the only thing that mattered was, were we citizens or not? Were we human or not? Not what kind of citizen or what kind of human we happen to be. Now, a lot of us don't remember when that ever happened, partly because that never happened. But the question is, should we simply just move forward, or do we actually contest this with telling our histories ourselves? I think the current battles that we have are actually narrative struggles as much as they are material ones. And as time moves beyond the present, the political struggles of this moment will be represented as conflicts over narrative. What is the story? Who gets to tell it? What gets elevated as truth and what gets left out shapes the way that we think and talk about justice for generations to come. So what I would like to do in recontextualizing stories of intersectionality is offer a travelogue of my own. It's a series of stories about my relationship with intersectionality through narrative. And what I want to do here is amplify the view of intersectionality as a practice forged in talking back. Talking back is one of the critical dimensions of social justice advocates. My friend George Lipsitz reminded me that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was said to be so immersed in the art of talking back that they would talk back to a stop sign. I learned the art of talking back from my parents, and that talking back was the grounding for the work that I eventually did in intersectionality. So I'm going to draw from that talking back tradition and share some pieces from my forthcoming book, in which I resituate intersectionality in some of the defining moments in my own involvement, including my involvement with Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, O.J. Simpson trial, my involvement in the World Conference on Racism. I also lift up current campaigns such as Say Her Name, along with the overlooked impact of punishment on women and girls of color and queer and othered people. I address Black Girls Matter, Why We Can't Wait campaign, which is part and parcel of a gender-blind anti-racism, and also the ways in which race-blind feminism has shaped many of the politics around gender. I also look at misogynoir in hip-hop and politics, among other things. Now, these engagements reflect not only intersectionality in an abstract academic way of thinking, but as backtalk that builds from the ground up rather than top down. Now, my own appetite for backtalk was nurtured by examples set by my parents, who talked back against racism in the 60s and 70s. It was activated by feminists backtalking in anti-racist spaces, by anti-racists backtalking in feminist spaces, and by critical legal backtalking in liberal legalist spaces. Backtalking is part of our legacy as critical thinkers and social justice advocates. Backtalking is the story of my personal that became political, that paved my way to the law, and from the law to intersectionality. So like many lifelong journeys, mine begins at home. Tangled roots. I grew up as the daughter of school teachers in northeastern Ohio. It's an industrial town that some called Little Chicago. Canton is a point along the great black migration north, best known for its role as being the home of America's favorite Sunday pastime, football. Not your football, our football, the kind that gives people concussions and all that. In Canton, miles away from open defiance of the racial order that was taking place in Cleveland and Detroit, smaller acts of resistance were unfolding, grounded in a notion of an aggregate we, struggling for freedom that transcended race, that transcended region, class, education, and religion. It was our collective erasure from most images of American life that made my family run to the television when someone would send the alert, colored on TV. Whether colored on TV referred to sports heroes or entertainers, it was an invitation for everyone to stop whatever they were doing and hope and pray. Now, especially when that colored on TV was a political leader, whether it was Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, or even a literary notable like James Baldwin, the occasion would be electric but tense. These figures spoke most directly to the stakes of the civil rights struggle, carrying the weight of all of us as we each, in a vast array of personal and public ways, sought to shift consciousness of white America about its citizens of color. These threads of presence and erasure decisively shaped my consciousness about my status as a colored child in mid-century America. Still a Negro, not yet African American, and only ambivalently black, until James Brown gave us the beat to move under with a new mantra of being black and proud. It was then that Cassius Clay became Muhammad Ali, forcing white America to bend to his bold act of self-determination. Olympians Tommy Smith and John Carlos swore allegiance to the black freedom struggle with their black glove salute on the world stage. And Angela Davis, a black philosophy professor at UCLA, bearing my generation's ultimate aesthetic of black pride, a glorious afro, became the FBI's most wanted woman in America. Now, gender as a social political hierarchy, both within the black community and in society at large, was not yet clear to me. But as a girl, I had an inkling early on that there was something in this group consciousness about racial barriers that I didn't really completely see lining up with the life that I was inheriting. Now, as questioning as I was, the five-year-old me hadn't been able to quite put my finger on it. Not yet. My rude awakening came from a kindergarten fairy tale game gone wrong. The game was a mashup of Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, with a little bit of Rapunzel thrown in. Now, sung to a simple tune, Thorn Rosa, was a group performance in which kids in my class would play a fanciful role on a rotating basis. We youngsters, a mix of colored, as we were still called then, and mostly Italian children, took turns playing the Wicked Witch, Fairy Godmother, the King, the Queen, the Handsome Prince, and of course, the star of the show, the girl of everyone's dreams, Thorn Rosa. Now, Thorn Rosa's beauty riveted the listener's attention as she was serenaded from the very first stanza. Thorn Rosa was a pretty
Thorn
child.
Rosa was a pretty child.
Pretty child.
Pretty child.
Pretty child.
Pretty child. Thorn Rosa was a pretty child. Pretty child.
Yeah, Thorn Rosa sure was pretty. And that was the crucial fact that made Thorn Rosa's story worth telling. And every girl wanted to be her. It was given that we would all eventually be chosen for the plum roles. The only question was when. So when playtime came to cast Thorn Rosa, my hand always shot straight up, so excited I could barely keep my bottom on the floor. Hoping this time I'd be picked, my body was a rush of anticipation. Yet each time I'd be crushed to be passed over yet again for the starring role. Not to be defeated, with determined resourcefulness, I sought to improve my chances by portraying the story's other characters with enhanced gusto. As the horse, I neighed aplenty. As the evil witch, my wickedly wilting glare turned the poisonous apple into seemingly superfluous prop as I threatened the sweet princess with all deliberate malice. Now, my teacher seemed to enjoy my performances, and seeing that I'd won her appreciation in these side roles, I was all the more confident that I would soon become the pretty, precious Thorn Rosa. But as the school year was coming to an end, it occurred to me that time was running out. Each morning began with my entreaty, "Please, Mrs. B, will I be playing Thorn Rosa today?" "Tomorrow," she'd respond. And the next day, "Tomorrow," again. As the last week of school approached, it seemed my entire world was coming to rest on my being Thorn Rosa. When finally, the very last day of school came, I pressed my case hourly, returning to my seat each time Mrs. V repeated the pledge, "Soon, Kim, soon." Despite my rising dread, I trusted my teacher, and I soothed myself by believing that soon would certainly come before the day's end. Finally, we were in the last minutes of the day, and the fear that I'd been able to push back down in the corner of my gut began to churn. Perhaps sensing my distress, my teacher quickly assembled the class in a circle and with hands held began the song again. "Thorn Rosa was a pretty child," they sang. Preparing at long last for my entrance, I took my step toward the archway of raised arms, and then, suddenly, the bell rang. School was over. My nose burned as the tears welled up, my heart beginning to crack. My classmates broke the circle to gather their things, happily running full steam into summer. Mrs. V, perhaps truly seeing me for the first time, came to the rescue. "Children, children, let's have one last song in the schoolyard. Come quickly now." So out we went to the front yard, hastily grabbing hands again, picking up the song just before my entrance. Thorn Rosa was a pretty child. I mustered hope once more to make my grand entrance. And then a voice of doom scratched the song. "Carlos, come, it's time to go." One by one, in quick succession, each of my classmates was called away by their families. The break inside me was now complete. The tears ran over my dam of denial, releasing a torrent of grief. Some realization that I could not name, or perhaps would not until that moment, overcame me. I completely fell apart, heaving tears from a place that I could not define. My sobs summoned my older brother from the other side of the playground, rushing over to confront whomever it was who had beaten his baby sister down. To his frantic questions, I could only repeat "Thorn Rosa" over and over again. "Who is this Thorn Rosa?" my brother asked, helplessly turning to others. "Who are her people? Where do they live?" My wrist was now held to my forehead, assuming the posture of all damsels in distress that I'd seen in old black and white movies. I could only put one foot forward before the other, crying, "Thorn Rosa, Thorn Rosa," as my somber cast of friends followed me home in a funeral-like procession. Reaching home, I threw myself on my bed, now shuddering and nearly catatonic. Falling asleep between sniffles that would momentarily dull the catastrophic loss of Thorn Rosa, I heard my parents on the phone, first with their polite white voices on, and then, as their frustration over non-responsive replies mounted, their black voices emerged. I sank back into the well, and in short order, I heard the doorbell and then footsteps coming into my room and a gentle impression on my bed. It was Mrs. V, shushing my chair, tears caressing my back. Despite my surprise, it was too little, too late. I'd been betrayed, thinking that by being a good sport and a smart little girl, I could be Thorn Rosa. Now I knew that no matter what I did, I was not Prince's material. Mrs. B apologized, making still more promises. Next year, she said, when we come back to school, you'll be Thorn Rosa. I promise. Well, I was a child, but I wasn't stupid. I knew that there was no future for me as Thorn Rosa. The cold reality was that even fairy tales were racially segregated. Our own fantasies of being pretty little princesses were rudely interrupted by white-only signs. Now, this fairy tale that failed is perhaps a surprising preview into my relationship with intersectionality. But the grief, incomprehension, and injury forced upon me as a natural byproduct of a scripted kindergarten play was a sudden and convulsive moment of my personal becoming political. My moment of discovering that my girlness was deficient, inexplicably something less than the girlness of white girls in my school. Later, I'd come to realize that this particular deficit didn't have a name or even a place among the litany of racial injustices that we, black people, were protesting throughout society. It was an injury without a remedy, a hurt without a solve, one that rarely, if ever, rose to the forefront of any demand for justice or group recognition. It was the first moment in what would become a lifelong search for some indication that the racial burden of black girlness or womanhood mattered to anyone. Now, no small part of my deep despair came from what felt like unrequited love from my kindergarten teacher. Even though I adulated her, I came to see that our shared gender didn't bridge the foundational divide of race. Ultimately, Mrs. V wasn't any more of a role model for me than I was a little princess to her. Race made a difference, I would come to understand, in how gender was performed, validated, and expressed. Gender made a difference, also, in how anti-black racism would be noticed, understood, and addressed. Through a wannabe Thorn Rosa child's eyes, I noticed not only gender divides, but race divides within the gender divides. Like, it went without saying that our basketball team or our football team could be majority black boys, but it would be unthinkable, impossible to see the cheerleaders and majorettes as all black affairs. I noticed how even within our own communities of the we, racism that was readily understood in the context of some forms of discrimination was never remotely thought about when it came to others. I'd had my share of these moments growing up when racism and patriarchy came together, but the analysis of it didn't. Like when in high school, I was over the moon to be cast in the role of Lorraine Hansberry, the famous playwright who wrote A Raisin in the Sun in her loosely autobiographical play, To Be Young, Gifted, and Black, only to lose the role when white parents complained that the play was racist. Now, there were no concerns at all when I was subsequently recast in the musical My Fair Lady as the maid with no lines, who existed only to sing praises to Henry Higgins, for making the perfect acculturated lady out of a crude working class Eliza Doolittle. Yes, My Fair Lady was an insult to women writ large, but would my tumble from being a playwright in a black woman's story to being a mere prop in an elite white imaginary ever find an expression within feminism or anti-racism? Through fantasy and performance, I was beginning to put together the wider implications of my particular embodiment. Perhaps Mrs. V had done me a favor in relaying the reality early on that no princes were waiting for black girls to wake up, no beautiful locks would tumble down the castle tower to aid our rescue, there'd be no search throughout the kingdom to find the perfect black feet to fit the glass slipper. Yes, fairy tales set the codes for troubling gendered expectations, but they also told us who's not in the running in the first place. This lesson I learned at 5 and was repeated many times since, that there may be no place in the established hierarchy for a body that was black and gendered female. It was a readily available template from which I would later understand how Emma DeGraffenreid would encounter her Thorn Rosa moment when her foot didn't fit the slipper of an employee at General Motors. It was that encounter with that now routine dynamic that prompted the imperative to name the thing that left us betwixt and between. But that would come decades later. In the meantime, I found a place for Thorn Rosa, buried behind a cement wall with an epitaph that reminded me that white spaces are unsafe. But even though Thorn Rosa was interred like other symbols of childhood trauma, I would re-experience Thorn Rosa pangs elsewhere in life, not just in dominant white spaces in our culture, but in black spaces as well. Talking back, a black family motto. The hopeful ethos that was captured in Aretha Franklin's Respect could have been a theme song for the Crenshaw family as I turned 9. My father left his job as a school teacher to take on a new role as the executive director of the Canton Public Housing Authority. He spearheaded scattered site and single family dwellings across the city, hoping to disrupt segregated housing patterns and improve the quality of public housing overall. I was his assistant on Sundays after church as we inspected the new buildings that were rising up under his watch all across town. These times with my father were especially coveted after he enrolled in law school and his time became more precious. But even the time he spent studying strengthened our bond. It really tickled me that Dad was in school and he had homework to do just like I did. Peering over him as we studied in his man cave turned office, we were newly connected. Daddy was a student just like me. Now my mom said that Dad was certain that a law degree could only enhance his capacity to pursue his mission at the Housing Authority, creating in me a sense that being a lawyer was something good for the group we. Now the family we was also busy advancing this notion of group advancement, in addition to the power couple's Sunday performances as the church's ministers of music. We were out twice a week as mom and dad directed the Canton Police Boys Club Choir. The choir crisscrossed the Midwest, leading boys from 8 to 18 to deliver a message of interracial cooperation to large crowds and political elites through the arts. It truly was a family affair. My dad directed, my mom played the piano, my brother sang, and I turned the pages of mom's music while being challenged every week with the boys' utterly monotonous question, "What's a girl doing in a boys' club?" My parents' signature solo included the Man of La Mancha's The Impossible Dream, followed by an encore performance of If I Could Help Somebody. The latter, sung with an emotional intensity that filled the room, never failed to bring listeners to tears. My father's beautiful tenor phrasing glided over my mom's masterful arpeggios. steadily building as he climbed to his full power to deliver the declaration at the core of the meditation, then suddenly receding into pianissimo to repeat it again in a final whisper. If I can help somebody as I travel along, then my living shall not be in vain. I, like the rest of the audience, would be transfixed, watching my parents put to music the truth that our family aspired to live by. The we that my parents embodied were dedicated recruits riding a wave of rising expectations, committed to being of service to our community while agitating, performing, and hoping that with people rising up everywhere, literally, as we now know, around the world, there really was a sense that there was no stopping us now. Staring up at a sky while lying on my back in our backyard on one warm summer holiday, with the sounds of a distant lawnmower, the smells of freshly lit briquettes and newly cut grass wafting through the air, I was, at that moment, perfectly content. The only thing that I saw in the bright sky above me was a parade of chiffon pillows, softly beckoning us to all follow our dreams. Everything changes. 8 months later, the news of Dr. King's assassination shattered our bullish sensibilities that freedom was just around the bend. The announcement that Dr. King had been murdered filled my world with angry clouds as massive grief erupted across the Black nation. We grade schoolers in our neighborhood were released from school, and young activists directed us to the Jerusalem Baptist Church for a hastily organized memorial service. Crowded into pews, we were all speechless when the activists asked us if anyone had anything to say about Dr. King. No one stirred. The silence stretched on for more minutes, seemingly everybody waiting for somebody to say something, anything. And the silence was just simply unbearable. It just seemed so wrong that Dr. King could lose his life fighting for us. And here we were in this moment, unable to do anything to honor him, to say anything, to give anything back. Something blew up inside my heart. Before I thought better of it, I was on my feet, suddenly looking through the eyes of a skinny, bespectacled third grade girl at an entire church that was staring back. In those seconds of silent panic, I frantically tore through the remnants of the only public speaking I'd ever done. Children's Easter recitings, scratches of scripture spoken over dinner, phrases, sayings, nothing fit. At last, I must have downloaded something I heard on the radio, because soon I heard words coming out of me that were not mine. Words exhorting everyone not to let Dr. King's death be the end, to pick up where he left off, to continue to walk in his footsteps. The grapevine was yesterday's Twitter. So by the time I got home, my parents, grieving the loss of Dr. King, were waiting for me with open arms. My mom, eyes brimming with tears, announced the arrival of her little firebrand, while my dad swung me up above his head and brought me down to an embrace so tight that I thought he'd break me. It was a bittersweet day that faded into darkness. In a little over a year, my father would be dead too. In two distinct ways, the loss of these towering figures in my life fueled my trajectory to advocacy, to law, and to intersectionality. Dr. King's murder elevated the ever-present fact that I was born into a history that bequeathed upon people like me the countless burdens of slavery, a short-lived freedom moment in the sun, segregation. I'd been born into a community that had to fight for dignity, for peaceful existence, for survival. I'd been born at a time when this will to survive had again taken a public, aggregated form that was reshaping American politics and potentially the social order. And I would eventually see the vicious effort to break that spirit, to extinguish the passion for a world that was promised to us, being rationalized now by a formal denial that these historic crimes bore any but the most remote connection to the contemporary realities of Black life. In the face of this, whatever it was that raised me to my feet in Jerusalem Baptist Church on April 5th, 1968, took up residence in my consciousness and never left. Somehow, my sense that this striving could be served through mastering the law set in, buttressed by what little I knew about the likes of Thurgood Marshall, the first Black Supreme Court justice whose photo held a place of honor in my home. But there was more that formed my trajectory to the law than Dr. King's assassination. My dad's sudden death during his second year in law school left me with a unique inheritance. A stack of law books that I could barely lift, and a fancy Black executive chair that had been his last birthday gift from my mom. The chair swallowed me up whole while I pretended to read his books to learn, along with him, how to be a lawyer. So it was settled. I'd be a lawyer to continue the dreams of my father, my mother, Dr. King, and the ancestors. Now, my time in law school, perhaps it's best framed as a story for another day, revealed that the magic that I thought I'd find there, the special abracadabra that would open up the floodgates to justice, releasing us from the continuing bonds of gender and race subordination, just wasn't there. I learned that the courts have been foes to our aspirations as much, if not more, than they've been a friend to us. I've learned that we'd been here before, and that unless we took very seriously the study of how the law actually produces race and gender power, not always explicitly, but nonetheless materially, we would inevitably be tied at the hip to an institutional frenemy without fully understanding the costs and consequences of a contested relationship. I needed another vantage point to find those people who prayed to this disciplinary God with one eye open. This is the journey that led me to critical race theory. Now, critical race theory as a pedagogy of resistance was in many ways a coming to fruition of years of activism and studies that propelled tens of thousands of people to press for a different stake in the social order. But like the movements that were its precursor, the intersectional consciousness that grounded these movements revealed dimensions of power that played out not only against socially marginalized groups, but within those groups as well. Gender would at many times interrupt this vision of solidarity. While feminisms of various brands were rightly surveilled for their potential Eurocentricity, imperialism, or solipsisms, as the more erudite among us would say, anti-racism's maleness was tolerated, excused, and often legitimized. These asymmetrical responses to male privilege on one hand and white privilege on the other reflected a pattern that I struggled with during college, law school, and beyond. Being the backbone of social movements, but never fully having a seat at the agenda-setting table, was a condition of Black women's leadership that our foremothers and sisters have denounced for generations. But for me, it took an encounter that still resonates today that allowed for that spirit to be fully integrated into my talking back DNA. It was another moment, the last that I share here, in which my path to intersectional thinking and acting was laid before me. Back doors, no more. Now, the moment takes me back to a trio of Black law students, including myself and two other Black men, at Harvard Law School. We were study buddies. One of the men in the group was a graduate of Harvard College, and a proud member of a prestigious and formerly all-white male drinking society known as, we'll call it, the F Club. Home to elite Harvard men, including former presidents, captains of industry, sons of wealthy families, our friend regularly regaled us with stories about the artifacts of wealth and privilege that adorned the game room, with walls literally adorned with the heads of dead animals accumulated by the likes of dead presidents who killed them on safari. Our friend made good on a promise extended over the year to invite us into this fabled place for a celebratory evening, perhaps as his first black guest. The two of us, the invited two, were cautious. We weren't entirely sure that a visit into this place where even our host was an exception was the ideal way to celebrate the end of exams. We eventually came to agreement that we would go only under conditions that would not compromise our dignity. We weren't going to take any shit from anyone at the F Club. And at the first sign of trouble, we agreed we would stand our ground. So, duly bonded together, we arrived at the venue and knocked at the door to announce our arrival. Our friend opened the door, but instead of clearing the path for our entry, sheepishly stepped outside, cutting off our pathway to the club. Now, assuming we were now about to be confronted with precisely the kind of shit we said we weren't going to take, we assumed the trigger position. With arms crossed and brows furrowed, we got ready to rumble. Our friend, sensing the escalation, entreated us to relax. "It's not what you think," he assured us, quickly updating the evening's plan with what was to him a minor detail. "I forgot to tell you that Kim is going to have to go around through the back door," he explained. "Women can't enter through the front door." And sure enough, my friend beside me promptly disarmed. This did not apparently count as shit. At least not for him. For me, the agreement not to take any shit meant anything at all, and it was aimed squarely at whatever kind of shit stood in the way of our full enjoyment of the club's amenities. It mattered not one whit what the specific reason was that I couldn't walk through the front door. In my mind, whether it was because I was a woman or a black person made no difference in our mutual defense pact. Yet my ally in this moment seemed to affix a sexist rider to our agreement. For him, shit clearly applied to things that were going to affect both of us in the same way. Racial exclusion of both of us, yes, that fit the bill. Gender exclusion of me, nah, not quite. Now, this was bad enough, but plainly worse was that they both expected me to fall into line as a second-class citizen of Harvard's patriarchy. Apparently, for the collective reputation of black people everywhere, they rested responsibility on me not to make a scene, to comport myself with dignity as a proper guest. Respectability runs deep for people who've never had it, and who better positioned to carry that respectability than women? Deep inside me, that Thorn Rosa floodgate of tears was starting to seep through a crack in the cement into which that painful memory had been interred. I was acutely aware that my brothers wanted me to step back and to accept the policy. I stood frozen by the realization that they would not stand up for me to be their equals, and the fear that they would judge me as a lesser sister for insisting that I do left me frozen. The imperative of being a solid race woman rang in my head from all the times in college and law school and elsewhere that I'd been lobbied to pledge allegiance to the flag of solidarity that never in return pledged anything to me. I might have refused to abide by this asymmetrical expectation. A stronger me might have bolted in that very moment, breaking away from the expectation that I danced to a discordant tune. But that me would come much later. My commitments at this point to this asymmetrical we ran deep. Perhaps I realized there were only so many battles that anyone can wage, only so far from home that any of us can wander while hoping for a safe return. For whatever reason, I watched myself go around to the back door with the consolation that they'd have to come through the back door with me. I cannot say that partying in the F Club that night was something that I could not have missed. In fact, for days after that night, I wish I'd turned on my heels and walked away. As if to underscore the disgust of my foremothers for succumbing to such subservience, whatever I consumed, whatever I drank in the F Club that night made me violently ill. My head was spinning all night. My churning stomach seemed to be urging me to leave a token of my indignity all over the understated interiors of F Club's so-called game room. The war inside my body was barely containable, but I was determined to hold myself together to perform one last act of defiance. When finally it was time to leave, I stomped loudly down the stairs and out of the front door and slammed it shut so violently that I believed, or perhaps I just hoped, that it would fall off of its hinges. Back in my dorm room, I held onto my bed for fear that without gravity to hold me down, I'd be bouncing around the universe. Holding my head on my body, I prayed for relief, making a deal that I would never again come close to imbibing what I consumed that night, physically, mentally, and emotionally. Finally on the mend, I committed never again to go around to anyone's back door, whether urged on by an ally, a mentor, a friend, a lover, even a black president. From that moment on, I determined never to consciously accede to the distorted notion of what respectability and racial solidarity requires, nor would I bend to any other form of unrequited allegiance, whether it was to colorblind feminism, American nationalism, or any political expectation that demanded fidelity in exchange for nothing. Perhaps because my humiliation that night was amplified by physical illness, my resistance to asymmetric solidarities is almost Pavlovian. I cannot bring myself to believe in or agitate for trickle-down justice with its promise that some of us can wait for equal treatment while the dominant members in our group, those whose oppression matters most, can be accommodated first. Rejecting this ritualistic marginalization, I have fully parted ways with allies over the expulsion of black women and our issues from the racial justice movement. I've parted companies with those who insist that we need to step back and let our brothers go first. It is why I believe that Desiree Washington was a survivor of the boxing superstar Mike Tyson's sexual assault and did not join Harlem's homecoming for him when he was released from prison. It's why I believed Anita Hill's testimony against Clarence Thomas and did not join the chorus of African Americans, many of them women, praying to God to silence her. It's why I declined to pack sandwiches for the men to attend Farrakhan's Million Man March. It is why I sought to tell the stories of black girls who have been pushed out of school and black women, girls and femmes who have been killed by the police as young as 9 and as old as 93. It is why I've criticized fellow feminists for failing to lift up survivors of sexual violence when their perpetrators are the police. It's least as why I see it across the social justice plateau. It is why trickle-down politics and wait-your-turn rhetorics cannot exist along with a robust commitment to intersectionality. Now, the F Club episode, it's my lodestar, the encounter that navigates my thinking. It disciplines my desire to be desired, to be part of the club, to be the belle of the ball. It reminds me not to ride or die for politics that won't ride or die for me. Yeah. Now, I say this with a determination that belies the fact that it is not always easy to stand outside, and that to refuse to go around to the back door has in fact had real consequences. In fact, there have been times that to stand this ground was way harder than any words can convey. And here I admit that many times when I walk by the many F clubs in my mind's eye, the places that will celebrate and accept you on the condition that you come on around to the back door. I sometimes catch a glimpse of my Thorn Rosa wannabe self, newly disinterred, laughing, tossing her flowing hair, batting her pretty eyes, and being toasted by people of all races and genders who, like her, exchange their dignity for acceptance. I gaze into the window and I feel a twinge and a momentary flight of indecision, and then I remember the drinks in there suck anyway. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all. I'm just going to very briefly welcome to the stage Claire Hemmings now, who is our official respondent, although of course we are all respondents here. Claire is Professor of Feminist Theory at the Department of Gender Studies here at LSE, and she has two main research focuses, feminist theory and sexuality studies, and is particularly interested in thinking through the relationship between these fields. Her incredibly influential and award-winning book, Why Stories Matter, The Political Grammar of Feminist Theory, and I think we all have just heard why stories matter, was published by Duke University Press in 2011, and her recent path-breaking monograph, Considering Emma Goldman, Feminist Politics of Ambivalence and the Historical Imagination, was also published by Duke University Press. Please welcome Claire Hemmings.
Well, I promise you that the drinks will not suck upstairs. I think one of the things that is really clear listening to Kimberly, after today, when we were talking about intersectionality as a theory, as a methodology, as a practice, as a politics, as a framework, is that it's also, of course, an affect. That intersectionality is a genre, it is a storytelling mode, and it is an affect. And what I'm gonna do very briefly, because I know you'll have lots of questions and comments, is just to pull out a couple of different threads from Kim's, I would say talk, but that would do it a disservice. Pull out a few threads that I want to highlight in terms of the question of affect. So Kim's work, as you all know, links institutional practice with social structures, but always with embodiment, the experience of Black women at the heart of theorization. In this, she joins and resonates with and echoes and chimes the history of Black feminist theories of simultaneous oppressions. For example, Hazel Carby's insistence in 1982 that Nirmal mentioned earlier, that, quote, the experience of Black women does not enter the parameters of parallelism, which renders their position and experience not only marginal, but also invisible, unquote. Kim also, of course, foregrounds the importance of navigating a path between a critique of invisibility and the resilience of presence, as many Black feminist theorists have done in relationship to her before and since. She insists that analysis of Black women's exclusion, their unrecognizability in legal and institutional or narrative and representational frames, be at the center of theory. She highlights in conversation with others and in the different registers of her own writing and thinking, the importance of theorization as embodied rather than abstract or universalizing, wresting knowledge production and its meanings from white men and carefully crafting its locations and interventions. Intersectionality challenges single access thinking, as we know very well, but it also does more than that. It points to the political motivations at the heart of those single axes, the privileges, thick or thin, and the networks of collusion that reinforce its logics. Kim's theorizations ask us to reinvest in solidarity politics at moments of time like the ones we're in, where re-entrenchment feels more familiar, and when singular insistence can feel like a more pleasing political affect. Hers is a deeply structural account of power and its effects, but one deeply committed to the capacities of individuals and groups at the same time. We will not languish, Kim says, and we will fight for recognition as the complex beings we are, but on different terms. I hear echoes of Valerie Amos and Pratibha Palmer's intervention challenging imperial feminism, of course, that called socialist feminism, as well as the dominant white culture, to account in 1984, and allowed Feminist Review as a journal to reflect on its own practices and commitments in ways fundamental to the shape of Black British feminism. I encountered that piece and the special issue it was a part of as a graduate student, and it was fundamental to early efforts on my part to grapple with white privilege from within a context of socialist and queer commitments. That work is ongoing, of course, and my own attempts to engage that always fail. For Kim, starting from both unrecognizability and presence does something methodological as well as ethical and political. It cracks open the known of knowledge and forces a different set of tools to open up different conclusions. Kim has thus generated in her practice and in the concept of intersectionality a strong methodology that, following Standpoint and its many variants, politics of location, assumes that something different about the world as a whole will be known when we start from Black women's experience, and that we may not necessarily know in advance what precisely that is, what precisely that looks like. As with Avtar Brar's work in Cartographies of Diaspora and Scent of Memory, starting from complexity foregrounds a not knowing, an openness at the heart of any Black feminist endeavor, as much as it refuses to dismiss identity entirely. There are then some feminist theorists who are able to do that impossible work of cracking and critiquing, but also of remaining in the principled generosity of complex thought. Kim is one of those people. And we have others here with us tonight whose work over time and in the present I want to acknowledge. In the introduction to her 2019 collection that Kim's narrative has so beautifully been pulled from, Kimberly asks us to contrast the false promise of inclusion with the politics of struggle that pushes and pulls and pushes and pushes against that falsity. I'm particularly struck by Kim's telling of her story of the princess, Thorn Rosa, which seems to me to contain so many elements of a political and personal history of intersectionality. Kim tells us two stories at the same time, it seems to me, as she often does. One is of the suturing of sex to gender through whiteness, a narrative and social building block of normative femininity. This sex-gender system is identified by Hazel Carby as one of the precise mechanisms through which racism and exclusion are managed in her extension of Rubin's classic account of the exchange of women. This system, as Kim describes it, takes place at the level of individuals and groups, is narrated and felt as much as it is imposed. Its motor is the promise of inclusion that tethers, that tempts, and that makes desperate. It is a story of a false promise that won't let young Kim be, won't just push her to the outside, but continues to want her, beckons her to keep trying. Tomorrow, tomorrow, the teacher says, while constantly changing the goalposts to ensure efforts remain unrewarded. But so too, this is a story of individual and political refusal that comes about at precisely the same time as the realization of that profound and devastating exclusion. Kimberly's bubble is burst when the false promise is revealed as just that. But she is importantly unconsolable. She will not be consoled by the teacher, importantly the teacher, the one who represents, even if they do not generate, knowledge. She will not be fooled into looking back and again to authority to restore her equilibrium. In this story, she enters a different temporality as well as subjective and political space, one that looks to a different history and a different future. In Black British Feminisms from 1997, a collection, Gargi Bhattacharya sketches out what she describes as the, quote, fabulous adventures of the mahogany princesses, unquote, telling her reader, quote, if you find yourself in a story that doesn't help you to live, give it up. Stories with no chance of a happy ending aren't worth telling. Save your breath, Bhattacharya says, for the adventures to follow. I've gained an immense amount from reading and listening to Kim's work, both over time and here today. Intersectional politics is all the things we know it to be, a different account of power and knowledge, a method for challenging single-issue politics, a framework for identifying the horrors of oppressions and seeking remedies. But it is also an affect, a description of simultaneous devastation and disidentification, a refusal of the bankrupt temporalities of naturalized relations of gender, race, and sexuality. The work entailed to take on that affect will no doubt be different depending on location and history. White privileged feminists such as me need to think carefully and urgently about investing and why we invest in the slim and deadening returns of limited recognition, perhaps, rather than grappling with the false promises as Kim has done here. But despite these differences, intersectional affect is perhaps also a poetics of solidarity, one whose tempo and grammar are felt as well as known, a way not just of distancing, but of generating and investing in the profound pleasures of telling each other different truths. Thank you, Kim, for your work.
Oh, one switch, okay.
I'm going to open up now to questions. We did start a little late, and I have word that we can stay on a little later. So there is time for a few questions. I'm going to try and gather questions, though, so that we can get a sense of what you're all thinking. And then I'll ask Kim and Claire to respond.
No, yes, no. Just Kim and Claire.
Okay. we'll see who gets to respond. So can you wait for a mic to get to you before you speak, please? And please don't be shy.
Thank you for your extraordinary presentation. I am completely fascinated and in love with this idea of storytelling as a Black feminist methodology, particularly in the context of storytelling as a survival technique for Black communities, particularly those marked by the Middle Passage and transatlantic slavery. But I'd love to talk a little bit about the idea we heard in one of the earlier speeches about testimonial oppression and the unbelievability of stories when they come from certain bodies marked by gender, racial, or other axes of oppression, and how we as Black feminists can produce our stories in a way that is read as credible within the academy.
Thank you. Could just a little bit further along the same row, person in the hat. Oh, it's not, it's the row in front, thanks.
Thank you. I just want to thank you for your work, and I just want to let you know that, you know, you probably know this already, maybe you've been told this, but your work definitely has saved the lives of Black women probably all over the world. Just having a word to say what your experience is and to not feel gaslighted or like, you know, you're not, you don't know what's going on is really, really meaningful for me anyway, as an 18-year-old. It's been amazing for me. I also just kind of wanted to, something that I saw it touched on a little bit, is actually how do we kind of make the idea of intersectionality more accessible almost to the masses, to say, to be spoken and talked about and discussed in layman's terms. I guess in the spirit of kind of understanding your enemy, there is an individual I just don't care to name, definitely not worth being in this space, but he is seen as the mastermind behind the previous presidential campaign of the now incumbent president. And something he said in a radio show was that policy and politics and the academia behind it is usually 20 years behind culture, and essentially it trickles down. And guess what I'm trying to say is, what are the efforts of people who, you know, who believe in intersectionality, who understand intersectionality, maybe yourself or people that you know, are actually trying to get it to the culture to make it more accessible. Because maybe I'm naive to believe this, but I believe that if it's in the culture, then maybe slowly it can actually be put into practice and be put into reality, and people can actually use that process to start to inform some of the things they're doing to help others. That's it.
Thank you. Do you want to respond to those two first?
Sure. And Claire, I'm calling you up with me, so any thought you have to. So I'll start with the question about accessibility. One of the reasons I started the talk with the song was I thought that was precisely the kind of accessible way of communicating what intersectionality is and isn't, historicizing it, and also telling stories. So I get a lot of stuff, and I was really anxious, you know, when I flipped on that one. I thought, oh, this could go badly real quickly. So I was really pleasantly surprised, and it convinced me that actually it can be done. I do think that there have been moments, even, you know, talking with a lot of my allies, like, what can we do to sort of counter the popular critique of intersectionality? Because that actually, I don't know if it's still the case, and I don't want to encourage you all to do this, but I do believe that if you type in intersectionality, the first or second video that comes up is a video that is a complete effort to trash intersectionality. So I won't name his name either. So, you know, we had some debates about, well, what do we want to do? And for a while, I have to admit, I did take the position of, I'm not going to dignify the crazy stuff with a response. But I think that's not working so well these days with a lot of stuff that we care about. You know, when they go low, we go high. That didn't work. So now, you know, the question is, what does work? So I think bite-sized pieces like that, I'd love to see, you know, more stuff like that. I'd love to see more comedy, you know, like that. There's something really funny, I think, about the intersectionality line. It's funny to, you know, just go around and denounce intersectionality as an identity politic and then say, because it hurts me as a straight white man. I think that's hilarious, but can we do something about that to get that, you know, sort of out there? So I do think that there's a lot of work to be done. I also think there's a bit of a tension, and again, I think we're moving to resolving it in a way of filling the availability of the term rather than not responding or responding critically to the fact that the term is getting far ahead of its ability to actually substantively do the work. So, you know, and I would say along with this that the fact that there are so many different interpretations of intersectionality, and some of them are actually counterintuitive and somewhat harmful, leads some people to say, well, we have to find another word, or we have to find another frame. I think you battle over the frame. I think you battle over the meaning. I consider myself a feminist, and I say that like, can you believe it? Because, you know, because the critique of the solipsism within feminism and the power blindness within feminism has rightly led a lot of women of color to look for another word. My position is let's fight for the defining opportunities to infuse the word, the frame, with the content that we want. So the upshot is, I think that there's a lot, intersectionality is everywhere. The question is, how do we infuse that everywhere with the meaning and the capacity that we want it to have to do the work that we want it to do? On the storytelling question, so I'm really interested in thinking about how this new moment of digital platforming of oppressive moments will or will not shape the ability to have our stories backed up by a sense of there is a reality behind that. And I have to say that I'm both hopeful and skeptical. I'm hopeful because, you know, there's stuff that we're seeing every day. And in some quarters, it is slightly shifting and creating a new sense of a new set of injuries, like the doing anything while black kind of injuries that now prompt certain people to see themselves as extensive arms of the state. You know, sort of slave patrols are now people who are walking around with telephones and are calling the police bring them in to intervene. And the fact that this stuff is now being recorded, I think, is elevating a certain way in which racial policing is something that private individuals are as much, if not more, of a part of as public. So in a way, it's creating newer consciousness and I think eventually a way of naming what this phenomenon actually is. So that I'm excited about. On the other hand, I'm fully aware that we've had many moments in the past when we thought, finally we're gonna be seen as credible because we've got some proof to back up our stories. And the time that I think about the most in this regard was when Rodney King was beaten. So Rodney King was beaten. Everyone around the world basically saw it. Many of us thought, at last we will have some traction on this effort to fight against police brutality. How can they deny that it is actually police brutality? That's what I thought the silver lining was. And it turned out we were all wrong. It was easy for a jury to accept the argument that was made in response, to say, he said he was beaten. Many people saw a beating, but what you actually saw was an institutionally correct exercise of force. Because if you break down what we thought was the video into 100 different photos and ask the question, was there any point in this beating where Rodney King was compliant? Well, basically, Rodney King was protecting himself through the entire beating. Because there was no picture that showed him completely prone and not moving, they were able to say that the beating was institutionally acceptable because you're allowed to apply force until you get compliance. What it tells us is that the existing narrative frameworks from power are always available to negate whatever story we tell. So maybe the point is to figure out what we can do on our side of the storytelling to actually motivate and mobilize more resources to get to the actual policy we want, rather than thinking, well, this moment of the testimony is going to do it all for us, because we pretty much know that it doesn't. The last thing I'll say is just this. I think there is a role of being able to go back and show through history when law formally created the levels of testimonial disregard that we see now. In other words, there was a time, as we heard earlier today, that people of color couldn't testify against white people. Now, formally, that's no longer on the books, formally. But do we think it's really gone? Absolutely not. So be able to attach this current moment in which the veracity of people of color is constantly undermined, unless and until a white person or someone in power can come and affirm it, to be able to link that to this was once a formal aspect of not only the American, you know, judicial system, but others, it's an anchor that we need to be able to have as part of our efforts to really raise the political questions of disempowerment through disregard of our testimonies.
Thanks so much for that. I'm gonna enter the Wayback Machine slightly and very quickly to talk about ways of domesticating methodology and the ways in which I think that's something that's disappeared over the last 30 years. So there was a time just after, I guess, the initial anti-discrimination critique, which was a 1989 Harvard Law Review article, where there were people who would say, you know, people on the sort of critical legal studies people who would say, look at Kimberly Crenshaw, she can do doctrinal work. You know, why are you doing all this storytelling stuff, you know, Pat Williams? And there was a dichotomy. And what I was struck by now as a kind of triumph 30 years later is that the synthesis of these two modes comes together where it's quite clear that it was always clear that inside of law, you're always telling stories anyway, right, inside of the doctrinal case. But you had this progressive white male maneuver, and you know, this was a conversation with Duncan Kennedy in the middle of writing a book that I then called The Tough Love Crowd, which was Spare the Rod and Spoil the Child, which was to say that black conservatives couldn't be called racist because they were black. Mm-hmm. So it was very much in that moment. Mm-hmm. And what was coming back as the resistance to kind of critical race theory was two things. One is the Randall Kennedy forgotten racial critiques of legal academia. So this is the black legal liberalism thing. Mm-hmm. But then the second move was to say, be like Kim, don't be like Pat Williams. And that question can no longer arise because both narrative and doctrine seem to me to be amazingly integrated in everything you've done in this latest book, but I mean, long before that, but I mean, it's just so emphatically the case that I felt like we should mark that as a moment of defeat of a certain kind of containment. So sorry, that was a bit,
Thank you. The very back, just behind you there. Thank you.
Hi, Kim. Thank you so much. It was absolutely amazing to hear you speak from such a personal place. I've got a question I'm not sure how to verbalize, so I've written.
Sorry, can you just speak right into the microphone?
Okay, I said thank you. It was amazing to hear you speak from such a personal place. I've got a question I'm not sure how to verbalize, but it's about queerness and intersectionality. I'm just thinking about something Rahul Rao said earlier, which is that queerness can often be a metonym for race, class, or gender, depending on how those identities or realities leave you in opposition to a certain sense of normativity. I'm wondering, based on that, how we think of queerness within intersectionality when it's such an enigmatic state or thing that's very specific to space, time, and how one feels personally affected by those oppressions. So I guess I'm trying to ask, how do we use queerness as an analytical category within intersectionality when it is so sort of threadbare and enigmatic?
Okay.
Thank you. And one last question. Sorry, I saw, yes, at the back here. Sorry, it's coming. Oh, is it on?
No.
We need to speak right into it.
First of all, I'd just like to say thank you, Professor Crenshaw, for all of the work that you've done and for your presentation. I just want to ask, from a Black British perspective, how you feel that we can mobilise a sense of collective urgency in terms of how we apply an intersectional framework, because I feel that at the moment, certainly within the sector that I work with, which is youth and community, that thinking about our work and how we provide services for young people, particularly young people of colour, and applying an intersectional framework is often left to the goodwill of individuals rather than a community or an organisational approach to dealing with this particular issue.
So that question was like really a great blast from the past. So let me just contextualize it for others who weren't following critical legal studies 30 years ago. Critical legal studies was in many ways the birthplace of critical race theory. Critical legal studies was a site where progressive lawyers and legal professors and law students more or less gathered around a shared effort to interrogate the way that law was not simply or even primarily a regulatory project to deliver equality, but was in many ways an institution that established the racialized and gendered interests that were the product of race and gender power. So, understanding law not just as something that was going to come and free us, but as something that actually had, for the most part, constrained and oppressed us was a simple but I think pretty accurate way of talking about critical legal studies. The problem with critical legal studies is that they understood this in terms of a class project, but didn't understand race as also being a product of legal rules, and consequently a critique of that was a legitimate project. So some of the fights within critical legal studies were fights between, we called them, you know, the old white heavies, who could really do the social constructed, you know, critique of class, showing how law produced class interests, but refused to do the same thing when it came to race. And actually, you know, the first time I heard of, you know, you're essentializing race was in the middle of these fights, right? So they sort of got into a sort of postmodern move on us, and we had to go and figure out what it all meant, right? So a part of that debate eventually became, well, if you guys learn how to really do doctrine, maybe there's a there. But if all you're gonna do is tell some stories, then that's not a legitimate intellectual project, and we're gonna continue to try to marginalize it. So some part of what your question referred to was that moment. Now, I would say two things just to try to give the more contemporary what happened after that. It's not as though storytelling and the work that I'm doing has ever received a warm welcome within the law school. So it's not like we're now at a new point. We're still exactly, you know, where we are. So, you know, it's not an accident that I'm over here at the Gender, you know, Institute, happy to be here. This is not something that I could necessarily waltz into my law faculty and say, I'm going to share my latest work with you. And it's a story about, you know, how intersectionality was, you know, a realization of some experiences that shaped my life. So I would say that. I would also say that part of our critique was to say, well, conventional work is also storytelling. It's just at a different register. It's advancing the stories of different people. It's elevating different kind of legal interests. We talk about that both in terms of the work that gets done. We talk about that in terms of what goes on in the classroom. I mean, there's a clear difference between what happens when a property professor starts a lecture on you know, whether you've ever inherited property or what you can do with your real estate, and ask how many people, you know, own their own house or something like that. That's not seen as a problematic moment of sort of self-narrativizing oneself into legal discourse. But if the question is, how many people have been pulled over at the border, and they start to try to tell that story as a way of engaging in a question about whether race should ever be a factor to determine whether you can be harassed by the police, that's seen as an illegitimate move. So we still haven't really been able to create the recognition of when there's storytelling that's, when law is basically narrative, when it's narrative of power, and when law is narrative and legitimate legal discourse when we're talking about the terms of subordination. So I appreciate your appreciation of the move, and also, you know, we can't celebrate it too much. We're not quite, yeah, there yet. I think the two questions I'm going to kind of put together, because I call them the where do I or how does it work kind of question. And a part of what I usually say when I set this up is, so my approach to talking about intersectionality is, A, not to talk about how can we do X, Y, and Z, or where does this issue fall. If you tell me what we're actually talking about, or what the subordination is, or what the dynamic we're trying to uncover is, then I can talk about, or what you're doing, then I could talk about, oh, that's interesting, I would like to lift that up, or I'd like to think about that, you know, some more. If the issue is young people in communities that are over-policed, are trying to develop interventions, but many of the interventions are not fully intersectional, like they're about boys and not about girls, then I can talk to you about that. I could say, well, there is an intersectional vulnerability that boys face, but there's also an intersectional vulnerability that girls face. And many times that doesn't show up when the framing around racist policing has always been gendered exclusively as male. So what can we do to broaden the framework and the conditions of possibility such that that enters into the analysis, and what are the ways that keep that from entering into the analysis? So I might talk in that context about how one of the ways that policing of black bodies has even become an issue that has bipartisan impact is because of fear. You know, fear of the black male criminal, people who fear them and people who fear for them. Within a political analysis, it says the only thing that we can actually advance are things that we can get money for, things that we can get a bipartisan consensus for. Those are the things we're going to move. We're going to be, you know, we're going to try to really think about what's politically within reach. That's what people are saying on our side. I can say that's a moment of political intersectionality. And what we need to do at that moment is talk about the consequences of setting agendas based only on what we can get bipartisan support for. That's marginalizing, that's exclusive. So I can work with that. But unless I know what it is, right, it's sort of intersectional from on high. So it's, and what I'd like to do is encourage people, if they think they've got an intersectional problem, use the concept and develop it in any way that's necessary to actually help elevate the dimension that you're trying to address. And, you know, I would say the same thing with respect to, well, where do issues around queer oppression, identity, and theory fall in? I'd say, well, what are we talking about, right? So what I talk about in the U.S. often is how marriage equality has been framed in a way that marginalized the queer within the queer, right? The families that can't be made into just the folks next door, the folks who don't want to get married, the folks who don't want to adapt to heteronormative frameworks as a condition to get rights. That, to me, is going around to the back door. So, again, it's context specific. It's not like I have huge theoretical mappings of how everything comes together. Some people do that, you know, but for me, it's about what we're talking about and then building up from that.
I'm sorry to have to do this, but we have actually come to the end of the time we've been allotted. Can I just say that we are hosting a reception to which you are all very warmly invited in this building on the 6th floor in the Shaw Library. So please join us then. And in the meantime, please.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Sorry. One more thing. One more thing. Do you want to just?
So we have one more event on intersectionality tomorrow. That will be at 6 p.m. It's intersectionality and colorblindness. So much of this conversation that we're having about critical race theory and the origins of intersectionality and colorblindness, we'll talk about there. And the 30th anniversary continues with a conference in 2020 at Columbia in April on intersectionality. So mark your calendars and come on over. And lastly, many of the events this week will be reproduced as in a podcast, Intersectionality Matters. So if you don't follow Intersectionality Matters or AA Policy Forum or Sandy Locks, please do, and we'll let you know when it's going to come out. So thank you very much, everyone.